Welcome to Make Your Shit, a podcast about empowering creatives like yourself to overcome obstacles, the real ones and the ones you imagined, to push through moments of doubt and indecision, to find the joy in the work that you want to do, and ultimately, to give yourself permission to make the shit that you want to make. I'm your host, Kyle F. Andrews. I'm a screenwriter, actor, producer, and creative advocate. I've spent the better part of the last decade helping artists, industry pros, and people who didn't necessarily see themselves as creatives take strides to break into the business, hone their skills, and most importantly, find their voice in an industry that just doesn't want to listen. On this week's episode, I talk with writer-director Zach Morrison about his independently produced TV pilot, Canusa Street. Yes, you heard that right, an indie TV pilot. We talk about a lot of different topics, from the highs and lows of writing comedy to where trust fits into the process, the differences between New York and LA when it comes to just making shit, and the fact that the best jokes in any pilot may end up happening at lunch. But first, a word from Bianca Lopez, the host of the new podcast Tinseltown Ghost Stories, currently raising funds on Seed and Spark.
The glitz, glamour, the gorgeous stars descending grand staircases. You think you know about Hollywood's golden age of movie making, but what about the ghosts lurking just off screen? I'm Bianca Lopez, and I'd like to tell you a ghost story, but not just any ghost story. With our new podcast, Tinseltown Ghost Stories, I want to take you deep into the shadows of Hollywood's haunted backlots and bungalows and find the skeletons lurking in its ample closet space. In the course of our show, you'll be learning about the people who built Los Angeles, the scandals that rocked the industry, and the broken dreams that still echo on the boulevard. We're looking to raise enough funding to produce a first season consisting of 8 half-hour episodes. Our goal is to deliver a quality podcast that is engaging, thought-provoking, occasionally spooky, and always fun to listen to. Hollywood is more comfortable when its secrets stay hidden in the shadows. On Tinseltown Ghost Stories, we listen to what the dead have to say, because the darkness is so much less scary when you shine a little light on it.
If you'd like to support the show, click that follow button, share us with your friends, and give us a shout out on Instagram and Twitter at MYS Podcast. If you'd like to follow me, I'm on Instagram at Kyle F. Andrews. Zach Morrison is a comedy writer and filmmaker from New Jersey who currently lives in Los Angeles. He is the writer and director of the TV pilot Canusa Street, which will make its world premiere at the TCL Chinese Theater right here in Hollywood this Saturday, July 1st, as part of the Dances with Films Film Festival. He also wrote and directed Everything's Fine, A Panic Attack in D Major, which was a 2019 Television Academy Student Emmy winner. Zach is the host and director of the travel series Space Tourists for the Space Channel, and the host, producer, and co-creator of the YouTube variety series We Have a Show. Zach has worked as a writer's assistant on The Tonight Show, starring Jimmy Fallon, and script coordinator on The Kids Tonight Show on Peacock. I had a great chat with Zach. I watched Canusa Street before we had a chat, which was very smart on my part because I had something we could talk about. I'm so happy I got to see it because it's one of the funniest pilots I've ever seen. We get deep into talking about TV pilots, film festivals, being funny for a living, being funny for a living on television. None of it is easy, but also when it works, it fucking works. Zach clearly works at it. I actually think that Zach's pilot has a good chance of getting seen and maybe getting made into a real TV show. If merit has anything to do with it, Zach will have a TV show in no time. So here it is, my interview with Zach Morrison. Hi, Zach.
Hey.
Welcome on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, it's really exciting that you're here. And, you know, I've followed you on social media for a while. We've hung out in person a few times. You have some really cool filmmaking stuff coming up. So this is going to be fun. But I want to take you back a little bit.
Okay.
I want to know how a guy from New Jersey ends up in Los Angeles as a filmmaker. Is that a natural progression? Or did that just, was that like trial by fire?
Oh, man. It's funny because the last place I ever wanted to be was Los Angeles. It was like, in my head, I was like, I don't need this. It's Frank Sinatra. Said if I could make it there, I can make it anywhere, like in New York. So I was like, I don't want it. I'm gonna do the indie thing. And then I finished grad school, and everyone was like, dude, you have to fucking go to LA. you know. And all the signs on the walls were like, you gotta go, you gotta go. I was working a job in late night, and all the writers there were like, dude, you have to go. And so it became the inevitable thing, you know. And then I had a short film that was doing well in the festival circuit at the time, and it ended up getting nominated for the Television Academy Student Emmy Award. Mm. And that kind of like brought me out here. And then a roommate, my future roommate, was like, hey, I got a room opening up. And it was like just kind of saying yes and to the universe. And I ended up in LA, you know.
That's so interesting. So you had that college experience of being MFA, getting your MFA in Columbia. So you're in New York.
Yeah.
But how long after you graduated? Was it like an immediate move after that? Or did you stick around New York to try to cut your teeth in the late night game?
No, I mean, it was really, I graduated May of 2018. And by November of 2018, I had an apartment in Venice.
Wow.
Yeah.
Since you were in New York, what's the TV landscape there like? I know that before the financial crisis in 2007, there were a lot of soap operas were made there, a lot of variety shows, and then everything seemed to come to LA. What was your experience like in TV there?
Yeah, I mean, I worked a lot in late night in New York. I worked at, I was a writer's assistant at The Tonight Show, and then prior to that, I was the writer's intern at Late Night with Seth Meyers. Did a little bit of script coordinating at SNL for a little bit, and it like that late night was sort of, that was for me, that was the world. You know, there were some TV, like there were, I think Billions, the writer's room is there. There's always like a cop show, and then whatever Tina Fey is doing. And that's scripted wise, it's not a very scripted heavy city. On the indie film side, like I think that's where more of what was interesting about New York was, you know, like the indie film world. Like everyone and their mother is shooting their indie feature in New York City. You know, it's and it's the best place for it, because you can shoot on the New York City sidewalk without a permit. That you can just go and do that. And that's why every indie film set in New York always has the walk and talks set, you know, outside of Central Park or something. And so that it was really neat when I was there. I finished undergrad in New Jersey at Rutgers in 2014. And at that point, I was already commuting into New York for work. And so between like 2012, 2013, and I left in end of 2018, it was neat to just dive into the idea of, hey guys, let's meet up. A, let's grab a beer after work, which is a concept that out in LA does not exist. You know,
like there's a whole plan that you have to build around.
Right. No, when I first moved out here, the hardest adjustment was my standard way of communicating was like, hey, man, what are you doing tonight? Let's grab a beer after work. You know, I'll meet you here. You meet me there. That doesn't happen here. But outside of that, the idea of like, oh, let's get together on a weekend and shoot a sketch. You know, hey guys, I have this short film. It's a one day shoot. Do you want to come over? Like you hold the boom pole. I got a camera. Let's just make the thing. And that was a normal weekend living in New York. And for me, that was so much fun. And because it's like, this is it. We're doing it. We're making movies. This is what we signed up for. Between that or doing like comedy sketches, or a buddy would throw like a stand-up show at his apartment, or, you know, I hosted a YouTube show in my bedroom for 5 years. And the idea was, it was like a late night talk show, but we were broke. And so we have to invite people over to my bedroom.
Yeah. A concept that you just have to really method that.
Right.
For sure. That was all part of technique.
Yeah. But it just, long story short, it was very, very just production heavy. Everyone was just making stuff all the time. And so TV wise, I mean, late night with like that for like growing up, I worshipped, you know, late night and SNL. And for me, it was a dream place to be. And it still is. And if anyone's listening, I would love to, you know, when the strike's over, be staffed on a late night show at some point.
And maybe one of those that they have here in LA.
Yeah. Maybe, you know, I did a couple of packets right before the strike started. But you know, that was sort of the TV world was it's late night, it's news, and then it's indie film, which is a radically different thing than out here, you know, and that kind of adjustment of like this LA being the scripted world and New York being the kind of stage show, unscripted, and maybe like Billions and a cop show, you know. And so it's sort of a different vibe.
So moving here, you have certainly had a change in the TV landscape, but as far as your indie filmmaking goes, has anything changed for you since coming out here? Are you finding that you're needing to now, you have to lay out the full plan before you go and make something?
Well, the thing is, I don't, and this is sort of, you know, the creator in me is struggling, is like, you don't shoot anything out here. And that sucks. I mean, it wasn't until the pandemic where my roommates and I, during the pandemic, one of which was a classmate of mine from Columbia and ended up being the producer on my pilot, we were stuck inside. So that we were shooting, you know, we would shoot little sketches and bits just to keep ourselves entertained. But in general, I mean, I don't think I've done like an indie short, like, hey, let's just get together and shoot a thing out here since I've moved out here.
Huh. Well, then in that case, how are you staying creatively active? Like, how are you, if you're not being able to, like, get the creative mojo going in the indie, just let's make a thing and do it. Where are you finding the creative inspiration?
I mean, I do a lot of photography. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of shooting for my own stuff. I do a lot of writing, and that's kind of what everyone does out here. But I always have something that I'm working on. You know, whether it's I'm shooting a music video for a buddy's band, or I'm doing actor headshots. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's like 5 or 6 different like half-baked ideas for either a podcast or a YouTube show that I've just been kicking around right now.
Sure. Yeah. As a guy with a half-baked podcast idea that you are experiencing right now, I feel like I can relate to that.
Yeah. And even right now, like during the strike, I'm working with a bunch of other late night writers, and we're doing basically like a late night show about the strike. And it's like we're doing monologue jokes about like AMPTP and Zaslav, and it's been like that's been fun just to like have that like creative outlet of like jokes. And then even just, you know, Twitter is a joke factory.
Yes. Well, good for you, because on Twitter I've seen that your jokes are actually funny.
Thank you.
Not everybody gets to have their comedic spirit come through on the internet. Twitter, some of us up at present here. But certainly I think that the emotional compact that you're making with yourself to stay active is helping you keep positive in that sort of thing when something like a strike is happening. Would you say that's accurate?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I feel like, and this is sort of the cliche artist in me coming out, but I feel like it's something I have to do, right? Like it's just, we have to, for our own sanity, we have to be making something. Otherwise it's like, what do I do with my hands? You know, I feel like our brains explode if we don't have some kind of creative outlet. So I mean, I've always just enjoyed it, you know, and I think coming from New York and having that kind of DIY sort of attitude about it, you know, I own camera gear and sound gear, and I've felt free in the sense that like, if I had something to shoot, not that I always have a project to shoot, but if I had something, I could shoot it. And I think that is enough for me to feel the kind of shackles of restricted creativity to not be there, you know?
Do you think something like TikTok or Instagram Reels are a good place for your comedy to get out to the masses? Do you see value in those kind of apps?
Yeah, I actually, during the pandemic, one of the regular bits I was doing was I was writing parody songs. And remember when the pandemic was funny? This was between the start of the pandemic in March of 2020 and before the BLM protest started, where there was like 2 to 3 months where it was all just like happy and weird.
Right.
You know, and I was just doing, you know, doing parodies of Springsteen or Southside Johnny or, I don't know, like just random songs where I'm just making them about the pandemic and being stuck inside. And that was fun. And I would put those up on Instagram Reels and TikTok's. I put them on TikTok, but like I wasn't getting traction on TikTok. And as a format, I don't think musical parody in the way that I was doing it was a place for that. I haven't cracked TikTok yet, but for Instagram Reels, like I try to keep it entertaining. I'll do just, I don't know, random bits on Instagram or Twitter are fun. And then since then, I, you know, like music and comedy, that's always kind of been a thing for me. So I love writing parody songs, and I've done a bunch about like the entertainment industry and, you know, and that kind of stuff also.
Parody is amazing because you get to take something that exists and tweak it so that it comments on something else. I would imagine some writers may be unfamiliar with how the parody process goes, how just overall writing for a variety might be different than writing your typical narrative. since you have deep experience in both, what do you find has helped you in one or the other?
I mean, for musical parody, I mean, I grew up with Weird Al, and like that, you know, I remember I would be in like Boy Scout camp and we'd be listening to Albuquerque or
a underrated brilliant song.
Oh yeah, but that whole album, I think it was Running with Scissors, which had it had Albuquerque, Your Horoscope for Today, which were both originals, but then it also had, oh man,
was Everything You Know Is Wrong on that one?
Maybe. Did that one have the Spider-Man, the piano man, like, sling us a web, you're the Spider-Man?
No, I think that might have been Poodle Hat or one of those.
Okay. Yeah, but it was that one, and then there was the American Pie Star Wars one.
Yeah, that was a great one.
So, like, you know, those were kind of the, outside of, like, SNL and, like, old Mitch Hedberg bits, like, Weird Al was always, like, something I had in my back pocket. So for song parody, I mean, I always enjoyed just being able to talk about something with a guitar is funny. Or even like the way that Dimitri Martin would do, like he wouldn't do song parodies, but he would just do jokes with guitar and that for me was always fun. So I've enjoyed like using music as a vehicle into comedy because I play guitar, I play saxophone and the drums and, you know, so music's been like an outlet for me as well. And then I don't know, on the narrative side, just I find the scripts that I enjoy writing are the ones where we're finding like absurdity in the minutiae of everyday life. You know, I think like one of my favorite movies of all time is The Blues Brothers. And what I love is like these are two insane people in this world, you know, or rather they're normal people and the world around them is insane. And, you know, we're using their musical numbers as a way to talk about, like with Aretha Franklin and Matt Murphy, like their, you know, their marital problems. And we're going to use You Better Think as the way to unpack their disagreements, you know. And so I like using music to articulate narrative and using absurdity of everyday life to sort of talk about bigger things. I don't, that's always been of interest to me.
You know, one thing I love about Blues Brothers is how it takes the basic MO of Saturday Night Live, a one-shot kind of sketch of, you know, something funny. You're watching two people be a little off, but then the film takes it and makes it social, and it makes it absurdly social in a way that I think early SNL was really good at and really primed for. Do you find that that has kind of made its way into the films that you make, specifically something like Canusa Street, which again is going to be premiering at Dances with Films in Los Angeles?
Yeah, thank you for the plug. That was good.
Good,
yeah,
I've been working on that.
Yeah, you're a good podcast host. Yeah, I mean, sketch for me was sort of, that was the first, I mean, those are the first things you do when you start doing comedy, right? Like I was never a stand-up. I don't enjoy doing stand-up. For me, that is a form that people have mastered and I will never. But the things we would do in middle school were sketches in the backyard, or we would do in high school, the senior variety. It was all sketch. And even in college on weekends, my buddies and I, we would just shoot sketches. And so the short form little nugget of comedy was always kind of the unit for me. And then, you know, when it comes to building, I mean, a comedy short film is sort of a sketch lengthened, right? Like a sketch that allows to sort of go forward. I mean, I feel that the best comedy short films are ones where it's one joke, but we're just yes-anding and expanding upon that core premise. You know, for something larger like a TV pilot, I mean, the Canusa Street, it's five-act structure. You know, I went for very, like, uber network. You know, we even have, like, hard act breaks. But it, for me, like the just unpacking different things and allowing the characters, either if it's like a crazy character, you know, reacting around normal people. And that's kind of what I Think You Should Leave does, like the hot dog sketch. It's like there's one insane person in the room and we're all going to talk about it, right? And Canusa Street is more like we have normal people dealing with kind of absurd premises, like a town where, you know, a guy is trying to hook up with his, you know, his mistress across the street, but he's now an international felon because he's crossing the border, you know. Or there's a salmon smuggling operation happening because there's a library that straddles the border and the bathroom is right on it and you can access it from both sides.
Well, and it's great because you can see how the nugget of having a street that is both America and Canada sort of allowed you to pull at the thread and pull at what is already existing inside a seed like that.
Right.
How did you find it a natural progression from the sketch of, hey, here's this street, to this is the character I'm centering this around of a border patrol cop? Was that just a natural progression, or did you have to work at that?
It took time. This is a premise that I've had kind of on the back burner of my brain since like 2017. Because when I was at Columbia doing my MFA, it was like, I don't know, my second or third year, and we did a writer's room class. And the idea was that the professor was sort of, we were simulating a writer's room. And so the professor would be the showrunner. All of us in the class would be writers for the show. And over the course of the semester, we would break the story and write out this season. And it would kind of be like a group, you know, we operate as sort of a team. And so on the first day, everyone had to come in and pitch a show. And I forget what I pitched, but the pitch that we went with was this like Narcos, Breaking Bad, guns and death and murder and rape and tribal politics on the northern border. And I'm like, hold on, guys, stop. Wait a minute.
Oh, the good stuff.
I was like, it's the northern border? This is Canada. It's funny. And I'm like, I'm the one comedy guy in like the whole school at the time. And I'm like, no. This, like, southern border, I get it. Like, we can unpack that show. I can see that show. We can write that show. You can do all of that. But if you say it's on the Canadian border, to me, that's hilarious. And they're like, Zach, please go sit down and go away.
It's Canadian bacon. It's the Canadian bacon premise. But what I like about Canusa Street is that it doesn't ever feel like it's making fun of Canada.
Right.
It makes fun of the situation of Canada's existence in contrast to the United States.
100%. And so that idea of like the idea of a sitcom or a half hour set on the Canadian border was something that was sort of percolating in my brain. Mm-hmm. And then fast forward to 2020 and the world shut down. And an article comes out about this town. And they, you know, because like they closed the border for COVID. But the article was like, wait, guys, there's one gas station and it's over on this side. And wait, there's homes and stores and buildings that are all cut in half. Like, can someone not go to the bathroom in their house? And so for me, the joke wasn't, oh, Canada, the joke, because that's kind of well beaten up. But it was more like, oh, the absurdity of this town shouldn't exist. Mm. To me, that was the joke, was like all of your hyper local laws on top of the international conversation we're having about border security, right? Mm-hmm. And like, you know, Mr. Johnson's bedroom is now in another country and he's illegally crossing the border. To me, as a premise, that's it.
It's hard to go in guns blazing on that, you know?
Right. And like, you know, and there's a real town where this exists. It's called Derbyline, Vermont, or Stanstead, Quebec. And the you know, Canusa Street is a road, a residential street where one side is American, one side is Canadian. And if you cross the white road stripe, you're an international felon. Mm, and there is a library that's built right on top of the border that you can access from both sides. And there was a gun smuggling operation that occurred there. And so a lot of it is very leaning on the absurdity of real life. And this, you know, the truth is stranger than fiction. But, you know, so this in 2020, when this article came out, I was like fascinated by it. And I remembered that 2017. Oh, right. Like the Canada Border Show. Maybe it will set it in this town. And as I'm writing, and the initial idea was it was going to be about a border patrol agent, because like you need some kind of workplace, you know, the workplace comedy as a structure for me.
Yeah, there's a bit of Parks and Rec.
Yeah, I'm a big structure nerd, and so when I'm breaking a story, like I like finding the engine and the arena and how, you know, how what's the TV show isms that we're going to root us in this place, and I think the initial joke was that both towns, the mayors were twin brothers. And they were going to be like a side character, and it was a joke, and haha, and we'll see this as a sight gag. And then my producer, Carver Dizerins, we were roommates at the time, we were classmates at Columbia together. He's like, hey, I know these actors who are twin sisters.
Oh, so they really were twin
sisters.
They were actual
twin sisters, Lauren and Sierra Tothero. And he's like, hey, like this is, you should make the main characters the twins. And I was like, oh my God, yes, of course, absolutely. So then very early on in the process, it became the leads of this show are going to be twin sisters. One's an American, one's a Canadian.
I will tell you, not only did you get twins, but you got two really incredible actresses in this. I mean, they are both, they're phenomenal here. I want to get into that in a second. First, you struck on something that I find really interesting.
Yeah.
This town exists, and it's so, look, I am a quarter French Canadian, and I am from New England, so it sounds like the perfect Vermont-Quebec thing.
Right,
it sounds
right.
Exactly like what would happen. That's not where it was set. We set it instead in Minnesota. What brought that about?
Well, so it's actually not set in Minnesota. We shot it in Minnesota. It is anywhere USA.
Okay. Yeah, so I saw the Minnesota. I was like, there. I'm assuming because it's not Montana and it's not North Dakota.
Right. I think in the pilot, I think there's a state highway sign that kind of reveals it as Minnesota if you're looking close enough. But no, we didn't want to pinpoint specifically where it was because the French Canadian angle, like the Quebec angle, is really interesting to me, and so I don't want to. If we get too far west, obviously that goes away. But there's like five or six of these border towns all across the northern border. Like there's some in New Brunswick, there's some in Vermont, Quebec, there's some in Vancouver. There's one I think, oh man, it's near Ontario or Toronto, on where like there's an American town and there's a lake in between the US and Canada, but like the edge of the Canadian side of this lake is an American town and you have to take a boat to get over there. But there are so many of these, and I just feel like it's just funny to me that, you know, with all the talk about border security and, you know, the border, the whole thing, like all of that stuff.
No, I don't know who you were impressing.
Yeah, no, just that random guy. But, you know, I just find it funny that, like, oh, right, there's also a northern border. There's like 5,525 miles of border that, like, most of it is literally unmanned and unprotected because it's Canada. They're our friends. But also, it's an international border. And so, they, you know, all of these towns popped up and, you know, over the 1700s and 1800s because we didn't care. It was all kind of nowhere land anyway at the time. And then it wasn't really until 9/11 where both countries were like, you know, maybe we should talk about this.
Well, that's kind of why I like the Minnesota angle. Even though you just filmed there, there's that little bit of Minnesota up there that's like, no, we're just going to grab this piece of Canada.
Right.
And we're bringing it down with us. Just pitching this out there. Season one reveal, they're in Tennessee.
Right. Right. And it's all been like they're in the Matrix. This is like a weird social experiment.
Well, it's like, just go with Lost. Everybody loves Lost.
Right.
You know? So, like, go with a little bit of Lost here. So it's going to get its world premiere at the Dances with Films Festival.
Yes.
Is this the first festival that you've done with a film before? What's your festival experience like?
So I've done a lot of film festivals over the years. I mean, I started, you know, growing up in New Jersey, a lot of my college shorts from Rutgers, I would play the hyper-local New York, New Jersey festivals, like Garden State Film Festival, Big Apple Film Festival in New York. The New York scene as a young filmmaker is fantastic because there's a film festival everywhere. There's like 19 film festivals in New York, like in one part of Manhattan, right? So it's just, there's always a venue. And then one of my old film professors from Rutgers runs the New Jersey Film Festival out of Rutgers. And so there was always a place. I always had a venue to like take my short and play it in like three or four different places and invite people to it, and becoming well-versed in the how to do a film festival, how to start calling up your local newspaper to say, hey, I'm a local filmmaker, I'm playing in this local festival. But my last project before Canusa Street, it was a musical short film. It was called Everything's Fine, A Panic Attack in D Major. And it was my grad school thesis film. That was the one that actually got nominated for and ended up winning the student Emmy.
Just based on the title alone, of course.
Yes, they didn't even watch it. They were like, title, great. No, but it was a musical comedy about a young woman moves to New York City, doesn't know what she is doing with her life, and has her quarter life crisis. And if her name's Zoe, and gender swap that, and it's my life. You know, very autobiographical. And so that was the first time I started having, you know, a short in a festival like that that traveled the country. We premiered at St. Louis. We played a bunch of festivals on the East Coast, a bunch out here in LA. I think it screened at a festival in like Rome. I didn't go to that, but it did really, really well in the festival circuit. And so that was like 2018, 2019. And so this is kind of my first project since then. And it's nice to have like a thing again, you know, because I forgot how fun it was to just have people come to a movie theater and watch your stuff.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing how this goes because it is hilarious. Hilarious pilot. It is hugely funny. I laughed very. I'm so used to watching these things going, oh, yeah, that's good. Oh, I get it. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, yeah.
But I actually was like laughing and chuckling and beside myself and going, what's going on? I'm enjoying it. But it really is an enjoyable comedy. It's a pilot. It's a TV pilot.
Right.
You self-made a TV pilot.
Correct.
Wow, is that crazy? Or like, is there a path for this forward to take it to studios? Like, what is the road for an independent pilot?
Yeah, it's funny. If you asked me 5 years ago, would you ever shoot a pilot? I'd say no way in hell. You're crazy. That's DOA. It's like there's no it won't play festivals because it's not a short. It's too long for a short, but it's not short enough or not long enough for a feature. So it can't go anywhere. But I just wrote an article for Pipeline Artists, like the Script Pipelines magazine, about this. I feel like the pendulum is swinging back toward, like, it's opening this thing up. And I think festivals are just starting to crack into this independent pilot space. Sundance, Slamdance, Tribeca, Toronto, South By, they all have pilot categories now. I mean, festivals like you know, Catalyst, which was the old ITV festival, and Series Fest, they've been doing it for like 20 years now. But I feel like your big mainstream festivals are starting to have pilot categories because, you know, remember back at like 2007, right after the writer's strike then, we had like 5 or 6 years of like the web series as a medium was really exploding.
Absolutely.
I mean, it was like High Maintenance, Insecure, Broad City, Booth at the End, H+. There was like the web series as a medium was kind of blowing up.
Crazy Ex-Girlfriend came out of that.
Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, exactly. I mean, and it was as an indie filmmaker living in New York, I was like, oh my God, yes, finally, we
this
can
is
do
the
it.
Time.
Opportunity, you know? And then Netflix happened, and House of Cards happened, and it was like, oh, no. So the web series is now a multi-million dollar television production. Mm-hmm. Web series is dead. There was a brief window where, like, there was eyes, you could get eyes on an independent episodic project. Mm-hmm. And then it went away. And I feel like now, like, post-pandemic, we're kind of coming into this, like, it's another space for indie filmmakers to have a moment. Mm. And I think there's now a world where you can make an independent pilot, because, like, I was taking the script out with Canusa Street during the pandemic, but it was before the strike. And the note that we were getting from people was like, oh, this is funny, but can we see something? And I feel like now, you know, development people, or they want to see visuals. And for a project that's very visually funny about a border and twin sisters and whatever, you know, we were getting notes like, it'd be cool if you could show us something. And so I was having conversations with my producer about what it, like, do we shoot a proof of concept? Like, what do we do? And, you know, kind of one thing led to another, and it just sort of made sense. Like, why don't we just shoot it? Mm. Like, why don't we just shoot the whole thing? We can still make it the sizzle and the proof of concept with it, but, like, we can also have a full piece that we can take to festivals, because festivals do this now. Mm. And, you know, there's a world where, you know, again, it goes back to your broad cities, your high maintenance, where, like, they made it. And that was that if you build it, they will come mentality that I grew up with my whole life. So it made sense to me. Like, let's just shoot the damn thing.
Do you feel like that approach is more necessary now in comedy, specifically getting comedy seen? Because I think comedy on the page can feel so subjective when you're reading it, versus if you've made something, then people get to actually have the three dimensions of the comedy. Do you think it's important?
I think it's always easier, in my opinion, to get someone to watch something than to read something. Mm-hmm. And this was a piece of advice I got when I was at The Tonight Show. This was back in 2018. I was the writer's assistant on the monologue team. And I was there for a couple of years. And so I was starting to get, you know, close with the writers. And I was having a chat with Joe Firestone, who was writing there at the time. And I was like, hey, like, you know, I do film, but, like, obviously comedy is my thing. Do I have to do stand-up? Do I have to do UCB? Is that the way in? And she said, no. Like, you know how, like, you can shoot things. So, like, just go and shoot it and put it up and self-publish. Mm. Because a lot of us did sketch or stand-up because that was our only outlet was a stage. Mm. Where we would have to, a stage show. We would have to invite people to come to this show. You can go shoot something, and that's sort of your superpower. Like, go film it. And put it up tomorrow, and don't wait for someone to give you stage time. And you know, at the time, it didn't occur to me just how true that was, of like, oh, right, we can shoot it ourselves. And that, so, and it was something I always knew. Like, I always knew, I got into this because I wanted to be a filmmaker, and mm-hmm. I love directing. And so that it never occurred to me just how, like, it was like, oh, yeah, no, of course. Like, it just, I took it for granted how kind of cool it was to be, like, I don't have to wait. I don't have to wait for, I don't have to hustle for stage time at, like, the barking shows where you have to invite 30 people to get 5 minutes, mm. right? I don't have to spend $900 a class at UCB before I can work my way to the thing. It's like, we can shoot it and put it up tomorrow. And it's funny, that actually, it harkens back to when I was a freshman at Rutgers, Spike Lee came to do a talk. And most of it was about, like, just what it was like to be Spike Lee. And he was a super cool guy and very generous with his time. But at the very end, there was this kid. And I was, like, I think running the camera in the back. So I was just kind of, you know, half paying attention. But there's a kid who raised his hand. He's like, hey, Spike, you know, I want to be a filmmaker. Where do I start? What do I do? And he said, do you have $100? And he was like, yeah. It's like, okay. So go to Best Buy, buy a camera, go shoot something and put it up on YouTube tomorrow. And we're like, oh, cool. Thanks. And he's like, no, I'm serious. Like, get the mm-hmm. fuck out of here. What are you waiting for? Go now. I'm not continuing talking until you go and start shooting your movie.
It's great advice that nobody wants to hear, because they right. think there's something more magical to it.
Right, and that's the thing. I think it took me 10 years to think, like, okay, yes, I get that, but then what's the secret sauce? Mm-hmm. Like, what's the thing I'm missing between point A and point B? And I was like, oh, like 10 years later, it's like, oh no, it's just doing the work and doing the thing. And so years later, when Joe kind of told me basically the same thing, just like, no, just go do it. Go make stuff. That's, you know, that's just always been the way for me. And so when the time came to sort of start having the conversation about what are we going to do for this visual proof of concept for this pilot? Oh, right. Let's just make it, you know, and let's like we have the ability to make it. Mm. We've done this before. This is what we do. Let's do it.
In the making of it.
yeah.
making the shit. What are the sort of boundaries that you're finding you're having to overcome? Do you see a boundary, or are there no boundaries when it comes to filmmaking? Anything is useful.
I mean, I think, you know, there's always that you know, you write to what you have access to. And to a certain extent, I mean, that's a very helpful tool, especially if you're on a limited budget. I do remember I had a TV writing professor in grad school who said, he was noticing that like everything I was writing was very small and very contained because I had my indie film producer brain overriding my creative decisions. And he's like, no, man. Write a freaking space epic. Like, write something that's impossible to shoot. You know, unleash your mind was the, you know, note behind the note.
I like to say, let your freak flag fly.
Love it. I mean, exactly. It's just like, be weird and be different. I think from the logistical side, you know, if you're directing a project, it's just time and money are your two constant barriers. And then it's just, what creative decisions are you going to make to best utilize the time and the money available to you?
Which do you think is more important, having money or having time?
Yes. I mean, no, really, if you have no money, that will force you to do creative things. If you have no time but money available, that'll also force you to do creative things. And I find that for me, like, the fun of directing is sort of like, you have a plan, right? And you go into it with a plan, but then you have to improvise, and it's that saying yes and to sort of Murphy's Law situations. And and thankfully, having a comedy background, it makes like improvisation, like that's a skill that I don't do improv on stage, but like I've done it my whole life. And so I know, like, being able to take a scene and it's like, oh, the scene isn't working. We're running out of time. What can we cut? What can we change? We have to make this work in a short amount of time, but we don't have time to think about it. So then it's just like, okay, cool. Let's cut this shot. Let's combine these two shots into this thing. We'll cut these two lines. That gets us out of the scene. Boom, there we go. Two setups, we're done. And, you know, you shoot enough shorts and you kind of learn how to have those conversations about camera placements and shot choice. And, you know, like being economical with your time as a director, I mean, that's the job, right? I hate when, you know, especially indie directors who haven't earned the right to do this. But even like when the pros do it, it pisses me off. And it's like, I will not compromise. We will, as long as it takes, we will shoot this 27 times. And I'm like, guys, come on.
Everybody wants to be Kubrick.
Yeah, but even even Kubrick was like, yeah, let's just shoot the thing.
I guess it depends on how crazy he wanted to make his actors. Right. But speaking of which, you know, making comedy means that you have to trust the actors to deliver on the writing that you've done in a way that isn't just authentic, but also provides the kind of comedic inspiration. We're going to laugh at it. We're going to not just learn about the character through it, but we're going to get a sense of I don't know if joy is the right word, but a sense of enjoyment from how the person is acting. How do you, as somebody with what sounds like in improv, in yes anding, sounds like you have a performance background, how do you direct your comedic actors to get the best comedy performance from them?
I mean, I think this is why casting is so important, because I want to work with actors who are going to bring ideas to the table that aren't on the page. I mean, for me, like, a lot of dialogue I write, like, on the, like, if you actually read the draft, it's sort of talking about nothing. Like, it's kind of a placeholder, you know? And, like, I make sure the emotional beats of the scene are being hit. But, you know, I want to work with actors that have ideas. They're like, hey, what about this? Let's try this. Hey, like, let's shoot it, but then I have an idea. And, I mean, that's the way I like to work. You know, I don't think that what I have on the page is always the best thing. I don't think that, you know, my initial idea for what this scene actually was is always correct. And I work with actors that I can trust to know what I'm trying to do. And I want them to also trust me that, like, I have their back and I'm supporting them and that I'm giving them the space to do their thing.
So it's kind of like you're yes-anding them from behind the camera.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very collaborative, I like it to be a collaborative process. Mm-hmm. I mean, on Canusa Street, you know, we basically had a writer's room every day at lunch where we were just pitching new jokes. I mean, even when we weren't like officially doing it, just the actors, they were just in between takes. They were like just riffing on different bits and just conversations that these characters could be having, you know, just randomly. And so maybe 2-3 days in, we started just writing them down. And there were one or two made the cut because we wrote them into future scenes because they were just so damn funny. Like there's this bit in the pilot where there's a visual sight gag where the Rick, who's the sidekick of Holly, our main U.S. Border Patrol agent, shows a sketch of what he thinks the smuggler looks like.
It's quite a moment.
And it is my favorite. It's my favorite joke in the whole pilot because it happened at lunch. Mm. Like the whole time, it happened at lunch, and we were riffing and just going back and forth about, like, because, like, in the description of the character, Rick is tall, dark, stupidly handsome, stupidly stupid. That is the only description I gave this person. Which I don't want to say. I don't.
It came across in the pilot too.
I don't want to say that's good writing, but that was, like, I think that there's something about, like, the Dogberry character from Much Ado, like, the idea of, like, the dumb cop is always been funny to me. Mm-hmm. And so we had this idea, and, like, they're knocking on doors and saying, hey, have you seen this person? And that's sort of, it's that police, you know, Law and Order kind of sequence. And at lunch, we were just talking about, like, different ideas for, like, jokes and tags that we could have to the scene. And at one point, you know, the actor's name's Jay, and he just kind of went off about, like, what if he confused what we mean? Because when we talk about a smuggler, we kind of refer to him as a mule sometimes. Mm-hmm. He's like, what if I got that wrong? instantly we were like, it was me, the actors, my producer, and we were all just kind of riffing and like throwing ideas back and forth. And then one of us found a picture of what the drawing could be. And we sent that over to the art department. Like, hey, print this out, put it on a note. We were shooting the scene right after lunch. So it's like that whole joke just made it into the show. And then we had to go back because the scene that would set that scene up, we were shooting 2 days later. And so I had to rewrite that scene so that way the setup to that punchline would be there. Mm. But long story short, that was because I had amazing actors and amazing comedic, but also, like, just storytelling talent around me. And we were able to create something in the moment. And, like, that to me is the most fun. Mm. Is when, like, especially on a comedy, but it's just like whatever you're shooting, when you are able to come up with something that was never on the page, but, like, is better than what you had on the page. That's like, that's to me, that's why we do this.
So, like, you feel like there's a time to say, I'm done with the writing version. Now let's see what happens when we actually put this up.
Yeah. And there's always, like, at some point you have to shoot it. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, there's the famous, you know, Lorne Michaels had that quote where he was like, we don't do the show because it's done. We do the show because it's 11:30 on a Saturday night. Right. And so, like, eventually you run out of time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it'll be fine.
I love your impression of Lorne Michaels because it's the Lorne Michaels Austin.
Dr. Evil.
Dr. Yeah. Evil impression, well, that Dana Carvey used to do.
It's that's my favorite inside joke of most comedy movies, is that Dr. Evil is Lorne Michaels. it's funny. At the at Dances with Films last night was the opening party, and they had an Austin Powers character impersonator there, and
great.
I was like, oh, good, cool. Good. I'm glad this is here.
Yeah, necessary, maybe.
Right.
Sure.
No, but to your point, I mean, eventually, you have to at some point decide this is what we're shooting, mm. right? And so that's my job as the director. It's like, yeah, I have to be the captain of the boat and say, all right, no, this is what we're doing. And I will always make sure for safety that we get what's on the page. Because I love improvising. I love, you know, riffing and letting characters have the sandbox room to play. But, you know, at the end of the day, I have to make sure that we also make the day. And so make sure we shoot what's on the page. And then if there's time, which I like to make sure there is time, then we'll play around. And that's kind of how I like to work.
It sounds like it would be really fun to work on your set. I think that you have a loose plan. It's a loose plan, and you allow it to adjust as the day goes on, but you know what you're setting out to do, and you still try to get there.
Yeah, and thank you. I mean, it's a tight plan. Like, you know, it's I'd say, like, I feel like a mistake.
I'm not just showing up at 10:30, you know, what are we shooting today, guys?
No, I feel like it's a mistake that, and I see it a lot, like, with my students, or, you know, with, your budding indie filmmakers that are taking on a longer short film, or a, you know, and it's the idea that a script can be a guideline. That a script, like, it's, you know, you hear about the, I don't know, like, it, like in a Seth Rogen movie where there's no script and it's just like some beats on a page, or, and I do not get how anyone can work like that. Like, that to me would drive me nuts. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want anyone to think that a script doesn't have to be polished and ready to go, because it absolutely does. Because for the myriad of different pre-production reasons, when you're working with the DP and you have to get you have to figure out the shot list, when you're working with your AD and you got to figure out the schedule, art department needs to know what they need to have there, the lights and the gaffer, it's just all of the, you know, you have to, the script has to be finished and locked and good. But You know, there's also the knowledge that once you're accounting for all these things, it is still a living document that you can play with within reasons and within the boundaries of what you're able to do within your time constraints, but also the logistics of the set and what you have available. So, but yes, I mean, I do like to play around. I love to let the actors do their thing, but I do have to, like, first and foremost, I have to shoot what's on the page.
Well, now that you have shot what's on the page, it is going to make its world premiere. Do you have a plan going forward from this? Is Canusa Street the center of your life for the next years? Do you have your next project coming up? What's next?
I mean, every time I've sat down to try to find the new project, more Canusa Street shit has popped up. So
it's not a surprise. It feels like a flagship kind of project for you.
Thank you. I mean, this is the thing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're just starting our festival run now, which is great. We were taking it out and meeting before the strike, and when the strike ends, I'm excited to start taking it back out. But we have, like, I have my fall, beginning to get my fall festival calendar kind of put together. And so, you know, I'm like, look, I want to get this out there and I want to find a way to make more. And so, yeah, I eventually at some point for my sanity, I have to write something new. And I have like 3 or 4 half-baked scripts that I need to just like throw out and start over. And, you know, I have a horror comedy, I have a musical drama, I have another like kind of jokey half-hour sitcom. And so there's a couple things that I eventually want to get to. But I mean, Canusa Street's the thing. I think that this is what I want to spend the next foreseeable future working on.
I'm really excited for you because it feels like this is the project that will help get you to be able to make things. And I'll tell you, I'm ready for a musical drama. We need more of those in this world. As far as Canusa Street's premiere goes, yeah, it's going to be at the Chinese Theater. What day and time?
Saturday, July 1st at 3:30 p.m.
Do you know if there are still tickets available?
There are.
Great. So let's everybody get on. You've got a couple days to get there. Definitely go see this. I have watched it. It is one of the funniest pilots I've seen. I really hope once this writer's strike is over, somebody somewhere picks it up, because we need a full 5 seasons of this.
Thank you. Well, hopefully 6 seasons in a movie would be nice.
I appreciate it, Zach. Thank you. Do you have time to stick around and talk some stupid fucking questions?
100%.
Great. All right. We are about to have stupid fucking questions with smart fucking people. All right, Zach, you ready for this?
Yeah, lay it on me.
All right. First question. What's your favorite Bon Jovi song?
My favorite Bon Jovi song is... Oh, man. You know, I thought... I was going to say Living on a Prayer.
Mm-hmm. Everybody says Living on a Prayer.
Because everyone does. You know, it's like... It's a great song. It's a great song. I think my favorite is probably I'll Be There For You, I think.
Oh, wow. Yeah. We're going for some soft little ballad.
Well, because I think that's like... That's where they're at their best. You know,
I love that you acknowledge that it's a band and not just one person.
Yeah, I mean, like anywhere,
it's a very Jersey thing.
Anywhere where like Richie Sambora can really shine. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, like it was a real bummer when he left the band. And you know, if the rumors of an inevitable reunion are true, then that'd be great. But yeah, maybe I'll Be There For You. There's Lay Your Hands On Me. Someday I'll Be Saturday Night. I mean, Runaways is great. So, like, I don't know. Anything from Slippery When Wet is a fantastic album.
I get that.
And then, honestly, like, it's a stupid song, but I really love off of Crush, Captain Crash and the Beauty Queen from Mars. Like,
it's the dumbest song.
It's fun. Yeah.
That is fun. Hey, you didn't say Bad Medicine, which I think, more power to you. I think that used to be my favorite song when I was a kid, and yeah, Now I'm an adult and I realize there's so much better out there. Which Muppet do you most identify with?
Animal.
Why Animal?
Because he's just...
Just because you're a drummer, or...?
Well, yeah, I mean, I play the drums, but also he's just, you know, there's that little spark of chaos in him, and I feel like that's fun, you know?
It is fun to have that little chaos, and everybody expects it from you, too. What was your best subject in high school?
My best subject in high school, I don't want to say writing. Like, I mean, I enjoyed all of my English classes, but... I think my best subject in terms, like, was probably high school physics.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Because that was, like, I hated chem. I hated bio. All of, like, the math, I was algebra and pre-calc and trig and all that sucked. Physics was, like, it was the only science class I didn't have to think about, because it was stick figures. It was just drawing stick figures and letting a ball roll down a ramp. And actually, and like photography, like light and optics, you know? And so I slept head down, because it was like the third period of the day. This was junior year in high school. And it was the third period of the day. And so I was exhausted. And I would just sleep every single day, head down, you know, and then the teacher would come by and he'd be like, Zach, you good? And I'll give him a thumbs up and I would get an A+ in the class. And it just, for whatever reason, physics was just that, it just clicked for me.
That makes sense. I mean, it's sort of, physics is kind of a director's job at points, knowing where the camera's going to be, knowing where the stick figure actors are going to be. Which TGIF family would you most like to live next door to?
This is going to get my comedy card taken away from me, but I forget what shows were TGIF.
Oh, yeah. No, you're gone. So that's going to be Full House, Family Matters, Step by Step, Perfect Strangers, a few others.
I guess...
Boston Public was on there for a bit.
Just from that list, I would have to say Full House, because that means I'm living in San Francisco, mm-hmm. which means I've never been there before, so I've always thought it'd be cool.
You're the new Kelly Kapowski.
That's wrong show.
Yeah. Sorry. I think the Zach Morrison thing got stuck in my head.
While we're here, we can talk. About
I was going to avoid this. I was like, I don't want to get into this, but let's do it.
No. So my name is Zach Morrison, mm-hmm. Which is close enough for people to realize, oh hey, like that show, and I'm like, yes, like that show. The weirder part, my sister's name is Kelly.
Okay, that is weird.
Yes. And so I've asked my parents, like, hey, look, you've cursed me with an incest joke for my whole life. So have you seen the show? Do you know what I'm... And they're like, they swear they've never watched it. And that's just everywhere I go. And for all your listeners.
Well, that's all right. Mark Paul Gosselaar is quite a wonderful actor. So,
yes.
He never gets the credit he deserves.
You know what
for
show
that?
Needs to come back?
Passenger?
Franklin and Bash.
Or Franklin and Bash,
I loved that. That was like, that was when TNT was having its like sort of resurgence moment. It was mm-hmm. like Franklin and Bash.
It wanted to be USA Blue Skies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was like Franklin and Bash, Rizzoli and Isles. And I think that was also when they were doing the Noah Wiley Alien Invasion show, Falling Skies.
I saw the first couple episodes.
Yeah, it's just like, there's this weird moment, like TNT was having a moment again. Mm-hmm. And like Franklin and Bash was one of those lawyer shows I just loved.
You know what? We need more of those. No more of this Snowpiercer, but hey, it's a detective show. Do you have a favorite Broadway musical?
Favorite Broadway musical?
As a New Yorker, you better.
As a New Yorker, I mean, The Producers, probably.
Yes.
Yeah.
Any shout out here? Well, actually, how about that? That can actually lead me. What is your comedic backing? Like, who are your comedy influences?
Oh, man. I mean, I grew up with, like, original cast SNL, mm-hmm. was always, like, first and foremost, like, Belushi, Aykroyd, Gilda, like, that was what comedy was, because that was just always on in my house. Like, my dad always had, he had the DVDs of, like, the, you know, Best of Belushi, Best of Aykroyd, and so, like, my first jokes that I knew, like, Bassomatic 76 was just one. I would do the, Dan Aykroyd with Bassomatic 76, that was always on. It was Belushi's The Last Flight of the Starship Enterprise, where he's Kirk, and NBC canceled the show, so they start taking down the set around him. And then Chevy is playing Spock, and like the NBC executive like takes Spock's ears away because it's a costume, and then he just like loses his mind. Like, so there's like those original sketches were always near and dear to my heart. And then as I got older, I started listening to Mitch Hedberg, mm-hmm. and I went on a Mitch Hedberg kick, and like the idea of the one-liner was fascinating to me.
His delivery is so perfect.
And then just the observations of like, man, I love escalators, man, because they never break. They just become stairs. We would just do Hedberg to my friend. Like, we would just do him all the time. And then that was also when Lonely Island and Sandberg started on the show. And so it was like Lazy Sunday and Dick in a Box and Jizz in My Pants. And that was the first time I watched TV thinking, that is what I do. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to do that.
You want to jizz in your pants.
If I could and it would go on air on NBC, absolutely. No, like, just the idea of the musical sketch, mm-hmm. right? And because I was always a musical kid, and, like, I played instruments growing up, and I was writing funny songs or trying to write funny songs in middle school. And so, that like, Lazy Sunday was the first time I watched a sketch on SNL thinking, oh, wait, I can do that. Because it also had that, like, indie filmmaker, like, vibe to it. Not just, again, not just stand-ups, not just, like, stage sketch, like, the way SNL or, like, a UCB show is, but I can film comedy. And, like, that was the thing that broke my brain. And then, you know, the Blues Brothers is, like, that's my Citizen Kane. I will fight anybody that's the greatest movie of all time.
Feel about Blues Brothers 2000?
Let's not talk about it. The music was really good. The story was very dumb. But I'm glad Paul Schaefer finally made a cameo.
Would you rather be stuck in a Groundhog's Day-style repeating day or a slider situation where you're shifting through dimensions and trying to find your way home.
I remember, like, Sci-Fi Channel was always on. Like, when I was homesick, I'd watch Sci-Fi Channel, Sliders was always one of them. It was like Sliders, Stargate SG-1, mm-hmm. and original Trek. And Next Generation.
It was good to be a nerd back then.
Yeah, it was great. It was a great time. I'd probably say Sliders, because I get why partway through Groundhog Day, Bill Murray tried to just kill himself a bunch of times. And I'd like, that would be a nightmare. That to me feels like way more of a Twilight Zone, like I'm going to go insane. Mm. So probably Sliders, because it'd be fun.
I think my favorite thing about what you said about Groundhog Day is that I know you're a comedy writer because you chose to shout out the darkest moment in that and the most truthful, desperate moment in there for him, which is really exciting. If you got an opportunity to write a film or TV show about any fantasy creature, monster, or cryptid, which one would it be?
I feel like Greek mythology for me has always been fascinating.
Oh, cool.
And I even as a kid, I really enjoyed in school, whenever we had like the Greek mythology unit in whatever class, we would have Greek mythology class or whatever. Sometimes it was English class, sometimes it was like world history, and we would just kind of touch on it a little bit. But I found that just the pantheon of the Greek like gods fascinating. And just the, you know, not like lesser so when the Romans kind of stole it all and changed all the names, but like the original, like the Greek mythology, I found interesting. Doing a show about like somehow incorporating the monsters and creatures of Greek mythology, I think could be really cool.
I cannot wait to see your comedy odyssey. Finally.
Yeah.
If it's your turn to order lunch, what are we having?
Is it a work day?
Yes.
Whew, see, that changed. That changed.
We're working. We have to get shit done.
We're working and we have to get shit done. Okay, so that rules out Italian.
Mm. for everybody's benefit.
All right. So, I mean, if it's a work day and we need to be productive, and I'm ordering lunch. I don't know. I hate, this is lame, but like, you know, you do like the filmmaker like craft, like lunch is like the salad bowl or the grain bowl type thing. Mm. It's a lame answer to the question.
It's a very producer director.
Yeah, I know. putting all of that aside, like you can't go wrong with tacos. Mm. But if we're in New York, like there is something incredibly satisfying about just like that slice of pizza off the street for lunch. Like I gotta be somewhere quick. I got shit I have to do. I gotta go somewhere. I don't have time. We're gonna get Leonard to stop at Joe's and grab dollar slice and move on.
That is the perfect answer.
Good.
Well, thank you for stopping by, Zach. I appreciate it. And hopefully someday we'll have a pizza on the corner.
Sounds good, man. Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
If you'd like to support the show, click that follow button. Share us with your friends and give us a shout out on Instagram and Twitter at MYS Podcast. If you'd like to follow me, I'm on Instagram at Kyle F. Andrews. For those listeners who'd like to go the extra mile and help me make this shit, we also have a no pressure Patreon over at patreon.com/MYS Podcast. You can find these links and more in our show notes.
I'm your host, Kyle F. Andrews. My consulting producer is Emily Castro. Our theme song is Keep On Dancing by Monday Hope. Until next time, keep making that shit.